Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Midrasha. If anyone hasn't been before, and welcome to Reverend Kimsey, everyone who's here. Please do help yourself to donuts along the way, they're coming round. We're delighted to welcome Rabbi Manning to the Midrasha. Many of you all know Rabbi Manning from when he was in England. He's now living in Israel and is a rabbi at MNY. And we're delighted that he has come and spoke for us today.
Thank you very much. Good evening to everybody. Thank you all for coming out. It really is a pleasure to be here. It's the first time I've spoken at the Midrasha, and I hope that at some stage you might have me back. It depends on, I suppose, how you feel tonight goes. It's lovely of you all to come out, especially to see Reb Sim Kimchi and all the other people that have come out on a cold night. I'd like to take this opportunity at the beginning to thank very much Sharon Baum for all the work and effort. Everything was highly organized, the graphics were fantastic, and everything was really super, top class, so thank you very much to her. We are going to speak about a very interesting topic tonight, which is really just going to introduce many of the issues. The truth is that I've squeezed 3 or 4 shirim into one shir, which I'm going to just give you the Rosh HaProkim, some of the headlines, and zoom in on some specific details. I make an unashamed commercial advert for the website, for my website, which has 9 shirim on this topic at length and 9 source sheets, etc. So if you are interested in looking in more detail, you can see the reference at the bottom there where you can find more shiurim. Hopefully tonight will whet your appetite and get you involved in this particular topic. Really what we're talking about tonight is something which is now often called meta-halacha. Meta-halacha means that rather than dealing with the specific halachic details of an issue, I could come and give you a shiur on whatever it was, Hilchas Bishul on Shabbos, or Hilchas Muktzah, or Hilchas Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, the specific halachic details, but actually we're zooming out into a higher level of, if you like, structural understanding of halacha, which is often these days called meta-halacha. I often like to think of it, and this is not the only way to think of it, if you have halacha like this on the bottom layer, then you have a layer of meta-halacha, which is the halachic structure, halacha, by which the specific halachas are decided. In other words, the mechanisms whereby different opinions are weighed against each other and different understandings of the halachic process itself. And above the top of that, if you like, you have this hashkafic framework which influences the meta-halacha, which influences the halacha. And this is a very important thing, because halachic details on their own can sometimes be misleading, and it's not always clear to people as to how to fit them together in a framework which is not only fits with the halachic specifics, but is also loyal to and fits with the halachic framework. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through. The topic title is, does the halacha still apply when the reasons don't? So the first question is, well, do we know the reasons for halacha? And I think there has to be a distinction here between two things. Number one, a philosophical understanding of halacha. What is, in abstract terms, what is the background to this halachic issue? And on the other hand, a halachic application of that in everyday life. In other words, we'll see that the Rambam has a very broad philosophical understanding of the fact that there are reasons to halacha. For various different hashkafic and sort of philosophical reasons, he understands that there have to be reasons to mitzvahs. And yet we'll see, in applying that in a practical halachic framework, he's quite conservative with a little c. He's quite unwilling to start applying the reasons and changing the halacha in different ways. So I think that is the first distinction one has to make. One can have a broad discussion as to the background and underpinnings of the halacha. But then when you ask me, well, what should we do? Should we change this halacha to fit a different reason? Oh, that's a different question. Okay, there's a couple of chairs, just one here, there's one here, there's one over there. The second thing we have to distinguish, I think, is between Torah halacha and rabbinic halacha. And there may be, and there will be, a very different background to that as well. It's so nice, by the way, to be able to speak to a group of people who don't make a fuss about my accent. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, no one's going to ask me to say Harry Potter or anything like that. A lady in the shir at the end of the shir said to me, this is, Rabbi Manning, I could listen to you read the phone book. The next time I'll just scrap the sheets, I'll bring in yellow pages, and we'll start from the beginning. So at least I find that people, it goes both ways, because no one's impressed by the accent here, so I can't just blind you with my Englishness, but hopefully that also means we can have a proper discussion. In terms of Torah halacha and Torah mitzvahs, there is a massive discussion in the Gemara and in the Rishonim and in the later thinkers about Talmud Ikra. Darshinan Talmud Dikra, do we take the reasons for the mitzvahs and apply those reasons in applying the halachic detail? This comes up most specifically in the issue of kings and wives. There's a whole sugi in Sanhedrin in Chaf Aleph, which I didn't bring you all the details for. I couldn't possibly bring you all the makoros. You'll find them on the other sheets that I mentioned at the beginning. The psukim say that a king shouldn't have too many wives, because if they have too many wives, they'll lead him off the derech. And he shouldn't have too many horses, etc. And they give reasons why. And the question is, well, what happens if the king can find wives that won't lead him off the derech? Does that mean he can apply the reasons and say, oh, like Shlomo HaMelech, I found wives and I think that they won't be a problematic bunch of wives. In the end, we'll see he was wrong. Or can you not say that? And there's a major machlokas between, on the one hand, Rabbi Yehuda, who says, we do not darshan time adikra, we can't take the reason for a mitzvah and then apply it halachically. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who says in principle we do take the reasons for mitzvah. This also comes up in the issue of, it says in the Torah, you cannot take collateral in a loan from a widow. You can't take collateral from a widow. Why not? Because there's a halacha that if you take collateral from a poor person, so you have to return the collateral every morning if it's something they need for the day, and every evening if it's something they need for the night. Since presumably a widow will be poor, because most widows are poor, and we don't want you going every morning to the widow's house, every evening to the widow's house. The neighbours are going to be saying, hello, what's this? Every morning his car's in the drive, and every evening his car's in the drive, what's going on? So the Torah says, you can't lend money and take collateral from a widow. You can lend money, but you can't take collateral. So what happens if it's a rich widow? She's got millions. There's no problem taking collateral. You don't have to take it back every morning. You don't have to take it back every evening. So there, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, okay, fine, so then you can lend money. Then the reason for the mitzvah doesn't apply. The Torah is only addressing the question of the poor widow, not the rich widow, and therefore, even though it doesn't say that, and therefore he says you can lend with collateral. Rabbi Yehuda says, chas v'chalili, we never understand the reasons for Torah mitzvahs. So already within the Tanaim, there is the beginning of this major debate. Let's pick it up from there and have a look at number one. In that sugi in Sanhedrin, the Gemara has a health warning. It says, "Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, mipnei ma loy niglu nifgalu, Talmid Torah. Why did the Torah not generally reveal its reasons? Sheharishtei mikras nizgalu tamam. There are two mitzvahs in the Torah where it did tell you the reasons." Nichshal behem gadol ha'olam, and one of the greatest of the greats, Shlomo HaMelech, he was nichshal. He stumbled on those reasons, because it says, "Ksiv lo yarbe lo nashim." He shouldn't have too many wives. And Amos Shlomo, Shlomo said, "Ani yarbe, I can have as many as I like, but lo yasur, and I will not go off the derech." Uksiv, and yet it says later, "Vayihila eiz zikna Shlomo nashav hatu es levavoy." His wives did take him off the derech, and he was wrong. He thought he could use the reasons to his benefit. Uksiv, and then it says, "Lo yarbe lo susim." You can't have too many horses. Va'am Shlomo, and Shlomo says, "No, ani yarbe, I can have as many as I like." Va'lo yashiv, and I won't take the people back to Mitzrayim. And yet, in the end, it says he did, and he had too many horses, etc. So the Gemara has a warning, and it says we're nervous of Talmud Ikra. We're nervous of taking Torah mitzvahs and saying they know the reasons, and when I think the reason doesn't apply, it doesn't apply to me. You know, I can, Shomer Negiah, doesn't apply to me. I can touch people, I won't have a problem. You know, I can control myself, whatever it is. The Gemara seems to be nervous about applying that kind of logic. Indeed, there is a debate, a fascinating debate in the Gemara in Brochas about Shluach HaKam. chasing away the mother birds. Have a look at number two. The Mishnah says, Ha'oime al-kan sipur yagiyo rechamecha. Someone who says, if the Shliach Tzibur is appointed, in those days the Shliach Tzibur was more extemporized, more, they would make up the tefillahs and they would sing, and they would invent their own ideas and poetry, etc. If someone stands up from the Amud and starts saying, oh God, you're so merciful, you're even merciful on the mother birds, to the mother birds. Meshakin, I say. We shut him up. We say, no. You can't say that. We don't want you to say that. You can't say things like that. Why? So the Gemara says, I can't support your girachamecha, my timer. What is the reason that we're nervous about people who stand up in the shul and say, oh God, you're merciful on the mother bird? So there's a machlokes. Pligi batrei amurai b'marova. Two ma'amuraim in Eretz Israel debate this issue. Rabbi Yossi bar Avin and Rabbi Yossi bar Zvida. So these two Rabbi Yossis in Eretz Israel, amuraim, debate this. Chad Amar once says, why can't you stand up and say, God, you're so merciful on the mother bird? Because how can you say, you know, which animals God is more merciful to, less merciful to? Of course God is merciful to the animals, but setting aside the mother bird more than anything else, it gets you into a whole philosophical debate. This yes, this no, etc. We're not meant to be doing that. The Chad Amar, and the other one says, because you're assuming that this mitzvah is because God is kind. Ve'ena ela gezeiras. And actually, you don't know why this mitzvah is. It's a gezeira. It comes from God. You have no idea why God said to chase away the mother bird. You're standing up in shul and saying it's because you think it's because of this. How do you know? Maybe it's because of something completely different. So it's interesting, in the Amoraim as well, there is a debate as to, one says, yes, of course we know the reason for the posik, we know the reason for the mitzvah, but we don't want to say that because it's like pasnish, it's not appropriate, the mother bird yes, and other things no. And the other one says, no, how do you know what the reason for the verse is? You have no idea what the reason for the verse is. And you find this mirrored not only in the Amoraim, but in the Rishonim as well. Have a look in number three. The Rashba says, even those mitzvahs where it seems from the posh pshat, from the pshat in the mitzvah, shenitna b'hem haTorah, that the Torah is given them shehatamim haheim heim tachlis hakavona b'hem. Even though it seems that it's clear what the tachlis of the mitzvah is, we know what the reason is. Eino tachlis. It's not true. You don't know what the actual reason is. Ela hatam hahu emes. Of course, the reason may be true. Achuka nekuda. It's only one tiny point of the potential reasons that we find from its potential intentions. How many hidden things are included in the mitzvah? Hashem, that God has graciously included in the mitzvah. There's no end to this. That's why it says with David, everything I see has an end to it. I can see the boundaries of everything, but rachba mitzvahs, no, I can't. The chema mitzvahs are sukkah, even with mitzvahs like sukkah, where it seems obvious. We sit in a sukkah because, you know, kiba sukkah is the shavti, so we know the reason. The chema mitzvahs min ha-mitzvahs, kol shekein, all the more so, it's ashalayin isparish tamei b'tayra, those which do not have a reason in the Torah. So even those things which we don't traditionally call chukim, how do we know the reasons? And when you get into Kabbalah, whoa, says the Rashba, Kabbalah, how do you know the Kabbalistic reasons for the mitzvah? So the Rashba is very nervous about anyone ever saying they understand any reason for any Torah mitzvah. You may have touched on one tiny part of it, but if the Torah, since the Torah is the Dvar Hashem, and therefore the Torah and Hashem, if you like, are not separable, or that if you like, undermines the unity of Yichud Hashem. The Rambam talks a lot about this in the Yud Gimel Ikrim at the beginning of the introduction to Perek Chelek in Sanhedrin. So if the Dvar Hashem and Hashem are inseparable on some level, then the Dvar Hashem has an infinity to it that you can't tell me, oh yeah, I got to the bottom of it. How can you ever get to the bottom of infinity? The Rashba says that. The Rambam says, no, actually not. We can understand the reasons for Psukim. Look at number four. The im elu hatzarim hanavshim, chasa toira aleihem. So, if God has mercy on people who are tzari nefesh, who are in pain, who are in trouble, the behemoth uba oifas, if it's with animals and birds, kol shekem b'nei adam, all the more so with people. So the Rambam wants to learn a kal v'chomer. Look, God is merciful to the birds and to the animals. How many psukim, how many mitzvahs are there of tzar bali chayim? but you can't take a limb from a live animal, and you have to unload the animal, you have to load the animal. You have to do many things to avoid tsar bali chayim, cruelty to animals. You can learn a kal vachomer, all the more so to people. V'loy tikshalai, and don't ask me, he says. V'amram arkan tipu yagiyuch recha mecha. When it says the Gemara number 2, where it says we shut the guy up when he says, oh God, you're so merciful to the birds. Don't ask that on me. Because you know, says the Rambam, there's a machlokes there. There's a debate there. One of you says you don't give reasons for the mitzvahs, and one of you says you do. Asher zichru. Ratzalayma das mi shechoshiv she'ein tam l'Torah ela haratzon levad. There is one view that says that we never know the reason, it's only Hashem's ratzon. Va'anachnu, but we, nimshachnu achah das hasheni. We follow the other approach, which is that we can give reasons for the Torah. So you see already, even though we'll see the Rambam in terms of halacha lemaisa is not going to actually start changing the halacha based on what he thinks the reason is, he's quite conservative on that. In philosophical terms, there is a fundamental debate that goes through the Tanaim, the Amoraim, the Rishonim, as to whether when it comes to a Torah mitzvah, we do or we do not know the reason for the mitzvah. And some are more rationalist and can take the view, and we'll talk a bit about the end, about how and why they are more rationalist. The Rambam, unsurprisingly, is more rationalist and says, we can, at the end of the day, get down to the reasons for the mitzvah. And others, like the Rashba, says, no, how can you ever tell me what the reason for a mitzvah is? It's infinite, it has infinite Kabbalistic depth. This can even spill over into some halachic debates in terms of Lamaisa. For example, Shiluach HaKam, why do we chase away the mother bird? Okay, so we've just been talking about that. But if the reason is to avoid cruelty to the bird, so then we'll say, look, if you need to take the eggs, and there's a mother bird there, so the Torah is telling you, don't just take the eggs, chase away the mother bird, and, you know, then have the eggs for breakfast. But that's only in a situation where you need the eggs, where you need to chase away the bird, but, you know, just to chase mother birds, like, what's the value in that? And yet the Kabbalistic sources say actually the opposite. The Kabbalistic sources say, do you know what happens when you chase away the mother bird? You release this enormous downflow, this shefa of a manifestation of the spheres called Ima, or the Pratsufim. I don't know anything about Kabbalah. Okay? I'm just saying what I heard, and I don't know if it makes any sense to me, whatever. There's a Pratsuf, there's an emanation of God called Ima. And when you chase away the other bird, mother bird, Ima, if you like, cries out for is her children, and there's enormous downflow of rachamim onto the Jewish people. So whenever you possibly have the opportunity, you have to be running around the forest looking for mother birds. Whether you want the eggs, whether you don't want the eggs, it's got nothing to do with the eggs. It's got to do with chasing away the bird and causing this Kabbalistic downflow. And the non-Kabbalistic, there's a tshuva of the Chasam Sofer about this. They say, Gevald, this is completely the opposite of the reason for the mitzvah. The whole thing is to avoid cruelty to the birds. And you're careering around the forest looking for birds and chasing them out of the trees? Because why? Because of some Kabbalistic. How can this be? And therefore you end up with a debate on this particular issue. I remember once there was a whole article in one of the papers about Shiluach HaKan and how this Rebbe did it this place and this Rebbe did that place, and they chased around the world trying to find it. And I'm reading it, I'm thinking, how does this work? And then you look into it and you realize this actually is the underpinning of a major debate that goes through this. So when it comes to Torah mitzvahs, usually there is no halachic nafkamina outcome, but there is a deep philosophical debate as to whether we can or whether we can't. Rav Sadia Gaon in Emunas V'Deis takes the view very strongly that we can ultimately know the reason for pretty much every mitzvah. Again, that doesn't mean we halachically apply that and change the mitzvahs, but this idea that everything is chukim, everything is ultimately mysterious, many of the Rishonim do not go with that at all. Today that's very popular as a view. Everyone is taught that almost everything is chukim. We don't know anything about anything, and it's all mysterious to us. Somehow or other, that message seems to come through loud and clear in the educational system. One of my Rosh Yeshiva, rather, I don't know if it's cynical or skeptically, said it's easier for people to take that view in life because then they don't need to actually try to work anything out intellectually. Because if everything is ultimately mysterious and you can never get anything out of anything, then why bother even trying? But it is an interesting debate as to how that is taught in school. I certainly find with my students, they seem to be under the impression that almost everything in Judaism is a chok.
But it's influenced by Kabbalah.
Yes, I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's influenced by Kabbalah. But it doesn't mean that they don't think anything actually makes sense. It's just that way because it's that way. Okay, fine. But let's move on from Torah mitzvahs to rabbinic mitzvahs, because I think there we end up with something much more halakhically applicable, and I'm just going to give you some of the headlines as to how this worked. In the Rambam, in Hilchos Mamrim, we see the Rambam talks about when we can and when we can't change rabbinic mitzvahs. Now, most of our rabbinic mitzvahs were created by the Sanhedrin. Very little was added after the Sanhedrin, which is an interesting point. The Sanhedrin functioned up until the end of the second Beit HaMikdash. It then went into a, if you like, a lower functioning mode once they were exiled, even slightly before the end of the second Beit HaMikdash. They were exiled out of the Lishkas HaGazis on the Temple Mount. And then he went into exile to Yavne, to Ushet, to Tiberi, all around, Tzipori, etc. And then he ceased to have any effect. Very little was added after the Sanhedrin, if anything. And therefore the question is, can we nowadays overrule the Dinei Derabbanan, rabbinic laws which were created by the Sanhedrin? So the Rambam says like this, based in Shagazru Gezerah, I mean number 5, based in Shagazru Gezerah or Tikni Sakana Bein Higu Minak, if the Beis Din, he's talking about the Sanhedrin here, the Beis Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim, made a Minak, made a Gezerah, made a Takana, and this spread around the Jewish people. The Amad Achareihim based in Acher, and a later based in comes. Ubikesh Levatel Devarim Harishonim. They want to cancel out the earlier based in. Ula Akaroise Takana, and they want to get rid of that Takana Va'oise Gezer Va'oise Minat. When can they and when can't they? Says the Rambam. Ein Yochel Achi Yegodl Min Harishonim Bechachmonim. The only time a based in later can override an earlier decision by an earlier Sanhedrin is if the later Sanhedrin is greater in Chochmah, in wisdom, and in Minyan, which the Rambam describes means the number of people that follow the national, if you like, support for that Sanhedrin. Which basically means today, we clearly do not have a Sanhedrin which is greater in Chochmah and Minyan than the ones that made the rabbinic system that we have. So we can't overturn anything. Says the Rambam, Afilu batal hatam, even if the reason seems to be no longer effective, should be glala gazru harishonim, for the reason for which it made the earlier based in made the Sanhedrin, or made the takana, einach roinim yicholim levatal ad shiyeh gedolim eh. So we seem to be stuck. That's it. We cannot today have a based in which is greater than Chochmah Minyan than the based in which created the Mishnah, and the based in which acted in the Beis HaMikdash. So we have to wait until Mashiach comes. By the way, this of course opens up, which I'm not going to get into tonight, so what happens when Mashiach does come? And even before Mashiach, because the Sanhedrin is formed before Bias HaMashiach. And therefore, if we can, at some stage, restart the process of the Sanhedrin, then this opens up the whole question of, maybe we can override some of the rabbinic legal system that we currently have. This is one of the reasons why in every messianic movement that we've seen in the Jewish people over the last 600 years, there have always been a group of people that are pushing to restart the Sanhedrin. This happened in the days of Rabbi Yosef Karo, after the exile from the Gerush Misfarad in the early 16th century, in Sfat, where they wanted to restart Smicha and reconstitute a Sanhedrin. This happened later. Even Napoleon put together a quasi side of Sanhedrin. They had a messianic kind of feel to it. Napoleon, by the way, wanted to build the third Beit HaMikdash. He issued a letter to the Jews saying that if I managed to conquer Yerushalayim, I will give you permission to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. It was a whole discussion at the beginning of the 19th century whether the Jews should be supporting Napoleon or supporting the Turks. It was interesting. I'm not getting into that right now. And even in our days today, there are lots of messianic movements within the Jewish people. I don't need to go into who they all are. Probably, you probably know, and that's a different topic anyway. But there are people who want to try and reconstitute a Sanhedrin. There is even a group of people who call themselves the Sanhedrin, which are a group of Talmidei Chachamim. They're not accepted by a broader mass of the populace, but they have a website. Cool, they have a website. thesanhedrin.org. And you can check out there the history of the Sanhedrin, etc., etc. Of course, the Beis HaMikdash is going to have a website, I imagine. If someone's clever, they'll have bought the domain name already. thirdbeishamikdash.com or something like that. If you haven't, then go out and do it tonight, because one day it'll be worth a lot of money. Fine. So the Rambam wants to say here that until such time as that happens, then the rabbinic system is not going anywhere. Okay. It's not changing. Even if the reasons fall away. Says the Ravid, before you turn the page, at the bottom of the page, says the Ravid, Amar Avram, 2 lines down in the Rashi script, from the 2 lines up from the bottom, Itza Shuke, or Shvake Yerushalayim, what about the decorations of the Shukim in Yerushalayim? What is he talking about? He's talking about Bikurim. There was a takana of the base of the Sanhedrin, that when they brought the Bikurim, So the Chagim, they would decorate the Yerushalayim to welcome the farmers that brought the Bikurim, etc., between Shavuot and Chanukah. Chanukah was the last time for bringing the Bikurim. Why? My son told me this. That because Chanukah is the olive harvest. The olive harvest ends at Chanukah time. So even before the Hashmonaim, even before the whole Chanukah festival, this time of year was strongly associated with olive oil, with the bringing of the Bikurim, etc. And the Chanukah, if you like, is the last point for bringing. That's an interesting side note. So it says the Raivad, what about this issue of decorating Yerushalayim? The Paris with fruits? Kasha ale? This is a kasha on the Rambam. Shaharishonim tiknura. Because the earlier Sanhedrin made that takana, but Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai bitla, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai cancelled it. Why? Acha churban, after the churban. What's the point of decorating Yerushalayim after the churban? There's no one bringing bikurim. So how could he do that? How could he cancel it? Mipneshin is batal hatam, because the reason has just gone away. It was clear what the reason was. The reason was no longer applicable. The time of the Rishonim, the Lo Ha'egodim to Rishonim, he wasn't any greater than the previous Sanhedrins, and yet as a Raivad he was able to. So you see already within this first debate the beginnings of a discussion as to, really, is that the case? If we're really sure that the reason has gone away in the rabbinic mitzvah, can we indeed cancel the mitzvah because the whole Gezeirah was dependent on a certain reason, and the reason is no longer relevant? And I'm going to give you about 25 examples. Of some of them we're going to look at the sources, some of them I'm just going to mention, of where this becomes an issue in modern day halakhic life, where there's a gezeira or a takana, a rabbinic decree. As I said, with Torah mitzvahs, it's really a different kind of discussion. But with rabbinic mitzvahs, sometimes we find the reason really seems to have gone away. Can we or can we not cancel or change the halacha? So let's start with the beginning of top of page 2, with Maim Megulim. This is a very obvious choice. Chazal made a gezeira, a takana, actually, not a gezeira. The difference between a takana and a gezeira is complicated. I'm not going to get into it. Basically, a gezeira is designed to protect a Torah mitzvah. It can be positive or negative in nature, but it's designed to stop a person inadvertently breaching a Torah mitzvah. And a takana is more of a lifestyle decree to try and introduce something important to the Jewish people. So one takana was that if you leave water, wine, or milk open for more than a few minutes, unsupervised, it is also to drink it. And Chazal are very clear about this. It's a mishnah mefureshes in Menachos, so you can't do it. It's completely also. If you left your water in the room, you walked into the next room, chatted for 5 minutes, came back, you have to throw it away. It's not talking about overnight. It's talking about any time. Why? Snakes. Because they had snakes. And snakes were all over the place. They'd crawl in, they'd take a sip of the water, they'd maybe put some venom as they drank from the water. They put some venom into the water, and then someone else would drink it, and they could be dangerous. This was not some, it seems, spiritual danger. This was a real physical concern. Chazal are concerned we shouldn't do dangerous things, and we should protect our lives. That's a very important mitzvah. So they said, you can't drink this stuff. Says Tosfos, number 6. Va'anu, but us? We don't have snakes. He was living in central France in the Middle Ages. We don't worry about this mitzvah anymore. Really? I mean, it's in the Gemara. It doesn't say in the Gemara, well, don't worry, because if there are no snakes, you know, it says you can't drink it. It's very clear. The Einloima, don't tell me, says the Tosfos, the Davasheba Minyanhu, that it's something which was made in a minyan. Minyan has obviously been 10 men here. A minyan means a constituted Sanhedrin. Don't tell me that we can't overrule this because it was made by the Sanhedrin. But Tzorich Minyan Acher, and we need a different Sanhedrin to overrule Lahatira. Ki Vadaihu, because I'm quite convinced, says Tosfos, or we're quite convinced, because she asked through Tchila when they made the original Gezerah, Loi Asra Eleba Mokum Shanachashimati. They only made the Gezerah where there were snakes. What sense does it make to say that this was a general Gezerah independent of snakes? There was a decree. It had a reason. The reason no longer applies. That's the end. Finished. The halakha's gone. That's it. You don't have to worry about it. Just ignore it. Which is fascinating. And indeed, the Shulchan Aruch rules that way. Yes.
But, in fact, this was Rabbanah and a Takana and a Gezerah. In other words, in strength.
Is there a difference between a Takana and a Gezerah? There might be a difference. The Rambam makes, well, between different kinds of Rabbanons, you mean?
Yes.
So we'll have to see.
Good,
although we will see Rav Moshe's argument in Chal of Yisrael, which is clearly a Gezerah, to prevent us from breaking a Torah mitzvah, he applies the same logic. So you could try and make an argument, we'll have to see how it all fits together. Okay, have a look in the Shulchan Aruch, number 7. Mashkim she nizgalu, drinks which became left out uncovered. Ask from Chachamim. The Chachamim said they were Asa. The Chayshin and Shemesh Asa Nachash Mehem, that they were worried maybe a snake drank from them. The Hiddel Behem Eres. And they put poison into them. V'achshav, but nowadays, She'ein Nachashim Metzuyim Beinenu, Mutter. It's interesting, the Shulchan Aruch wants you to know that there was the original Takana, but now it doesn't apply. It's interesting. He could have just said mutter. He doesn't. He wants you to know it did apply. Now it doesn't apply, and this is the reason why it doesn't apply. And the Taz explains there, like we said, the reason is because there was a clear reason, and the reason no longer applies, the halacha has changed. This, if you like, is one of the most obvious examples of where there was a takana, the reason doesn't apply, the halacha now has changed. Okay? That's number one.
What? If you are living in a place where there are snakes, you could argue that the Shulchan Aruch has put that in so that you might say, fine, we're in a situation where we need to bring that back.
Right. Would you say that it was an Issa Derabbanan or it was just good advice now? Right. I think it's fair to say that the Takana in principle, it's not like we overrode the Takana. We turned around and said, even if there are snakes, don't worry about it because we know better today. Correct. We said that, look, there are no snakes, and therefore it doesn't apply, but presumably if there are snakes, we'll see that with Chalav Yisrael. Very clearly it comes up. I think that's a good point. And I'm not just biased when I say that. Okay, fine. Well, maybe I am a little. Okay, fine. My Machronim. Everyone loves to talk about my Machronim. Okay? Says the Gemara, Mayim Rishonim Mitzvah Achronim Chayva. The washing before the meal is a mitzvah. You say a bracha, asher kidshanu, before bread. While washing after the meal is an obligation. Why? Mipnei ma'am rumayim achronim chayva. Shemas doim mechiyish, because there's this very strong salt. Shemasame esayinayim. And it can blind a person, God forbid. They would put their hands in the salt, and then they put their hands in their eyes. Presumably during the meal they're focused, they're not putting their hands all over their face, okay, unless they're kids, whatever. But they're not probably eating melach stomis, but a grown-up's focused on the meal. But when he's finished the meal, or when she's finished the meal, you know, inadvertently they may do this. That's it. They're going to be in trouble. Fine. Says Tosis in number 10. Tama demay machronim have mishum melach stomis. So it's clear, says Tosis, the reason is melach stomis. It's because of the salt. Kedama b'samach, as we see later on there, he says in Chulin. The Anu, and we, the fisher ain melach stomis matzui beinenu, we just don't have melach stomis. My nagum and my macronim, so we don't do my macronim. Just like we said with my magulim, number one, he says we don't do my macronim today. Why? We just don't have the salt. Here already the Shulchan Aruch is less accepting of this svara, of this idea. First of all, he brings my macharonim chova, which many people, especially Sfarim, as a minhag to say at the meal, because they don't want any mistakes. May machronim chova. They say we have to do may machronim. But then the Shulchan Aruch brings the yeshe einogim little may machronim. There are those who don't do may machronim. Says the Mishnah Berurah number 11. Mipnei she'ein melach stomis matzu beinenu, because we don't have melach stomis. The das hagrah, but you should just know that the Vilna Gaon, the biurah, and the bir hagrah on the Shulchan Aruch did tzarik little may gam ha'ivni. You have to do may machronim even today. Why? Because of a Magen Avraham, b'shem ha'mukubalim, like we saw in the Rashba before, there are Kabbalistic reasons for Mayim Achronim. Is it just because of the Melach Stomis? The Kol Adam is Abim Mayim Achronim, v'chein hichmir marashal, v'yam shal shloim, v'chein kosev v'brikhi Yosef. The Mishnah Berurah wants to bring lots of people who are actually a machmir for Mayim Achronim and say, no, you must do Mayim Achronim today. Even though there is an opinion of Tosfos that actually Mayim Achronim has fallen out now because we just don't have this salt anymore. I'm not going to go through the Aruch HaShulchan number 12. He wants to argue so strongly in favor of Mayim Achronim that he says even Tosfos didn't really mean not to do it. He's just saying, I want to give a limud zchus. I want to try and explain why some people don't do it, but actually even Tosfos surely would have said you have to do Mayim Achronim. Everyone comes out quite hard in favor of Mayim Achronim, but at the end of the day, there seem now to be two approaches. Some people in Klal Yisrael take Mayim Achronim as a chovah, and therefore they do it. And that's, by the way, why the women absolutely do it the same as the men. If it's a chovah, it's a chovah. Women don't, unless you say that women eat daintily and they don't put their fingers in the salt, whatever. But, I mean, we all use knives and forks today anyway. I mean, I don't know about in Israel. In England, they still use knives and forks. But the women, when it says my macaronim chovah, the women, of course, wash my macaronim. If you're following Tosfos, as it appears to be, that it's no longer a chovah, so you do it if you want to do it. It's a minhag, if you like. And if it's a minhag, okay, you can have a minhag for the men, not for the women. Maybe yes, maybe no. It depends on how you view the mitzvah. So Mayim Achronim gets a mixed reception, if you like, in terms of the reason. Yes?
Why, when they get the, why is, in this one they said a copy because of Kabbalistic reasons.
Right.
So it's important still. Where did he bring that?
He didn't mention this. Although there are those, I didn't bring you the whole thing, there are those that even bring Kabbalistic reasons for that. And say, even with my Magulin, with water which has been left open, it's better not to, because there's the Kabbalah. You end up with an interesting question, which is another shir, which is, what do you do when you have a conflict between Kabbalah and non-Kabbalistic halachic principles? And there is a set of meta-halachic rules as to how to deal with that as well. There's a whole Mishnah Brura that comes upon the parasha with Tefillin, where the person called up to the Torah reads along with the Baal Torah. So the Mekubalim say, absolutely not, under no circumstances. And the non-Mekubalim say, absolutely yes, how can you possibly say a bracha and then not read and not learn? And then the Mishnah Brura goes into a whole discussion as to what you do if those two things clash. So there is a whole Torah on how Kabbalah comes in. There are always Kabbalistic reasons for everything, so it seems. Yeah, because
here they bring it, and the other one
is right here. Okay, so partly I've selected the sources because here in the Shulchan Aruch he clearly rules his mutter in number one. Number two, he brings both opinions, and I brought you the Mishnah Berurah. But you should know if you look in the Nosekel, if you look in the Meforashim around number one as well, B1. So you'll see there are people who bring Kabbalistic reasons as well. But that seems to be more a Chumrah rather than the mainstream halacha. Chalav Yisrael is very interesting. Yes. The Mishnah Brura, it depends on who you ask, because there are different sets of meta halachic principles. The Mishnah Brura brings that if there is a direct conflict between the halacha and the non-Kabbalistic halacha and the Kabbalah, then the non-Kabbalistic halacha wins, partly based on that chas and sofa with shiluach hakan, etc. But where there's no conflict, the question is, do you have to be machmir like the Kabbalistic idea? We get this a lot. A lot of stuff that we do today is not, if you like, not a lot of stuff. Some of the stuff that we, like onions overnights and things like that, a lot of this is based in Kabbalah. And the Mishnah Berurah there says that it's good to be machmir, you should be machmir for the Kabbalah if it's not in conflict with the halacha, but you can't force a person to because it's not in the halacha. It's complicated rules. One of the reasons that Rabbi Badi Yosef, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was controversial. I know now it seems like everything he ever said everybody agreed with. But that clearly is not the case. That's clearly not the case. In halacha, certainly, not even talking about politics, I'm talking about halacha. In halacha, Rabbi Vagi was very controversial because he came from the school of halacha in Baghdad, where Kabbalah was very, very much part of the halachic system. And Rabbi Vadia made a massive effort throughout his life, even though he completely respected Kabbalah and was no doubt a Kabbalist on some level himself, probably on the highest level himself, he said it has no place in the mainstream halachic process. And he rooted that out, very much in the same vein as the Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was an unbelievable Kabbalist. Rabbi Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. He had a regular chavrusa with a Maggid, with a voice that discussed Kabbalistic ideas. It doesn't appear in the Shulchan Aruch. He doesn't say the Maggid told me this and the Maggid told me that. Rav Abadia felt very much the same way. If you're interested in learning more about this, Rav Benny Lau in Yerushalayim, his PhD thesis was on the Torah methodology of Rav Abadia Yosef, and you can pick up the thesis. It's been written many years ago. It's now published as a book called Mimaran Ad Maran, and Rav Abadia gives a very beautiful haskoma at the beginning, said he read it, or some of it, and he likes it very much. So if you want to learn more about that, then that's the place to look for it. Now, Chalav Yisrael, B3. So Chalav Yisrael is an interesting one. So the Tiferet Yisrael says in Kilaim, one of the Meforshim on the Mishnah, don't ask me about Chalav Nachri, milk from a non-Jew, and Stam Yenam, wine made by a non-Jew. Even though the reason has gone away, specifically in Chalav Yisrael, the Bishviloi Nesru, because the reason they asked it, we'll see, is because they're worried that the milk's going to be adulterated with non-kosher milk, even though he says, that's just not so relevant today. It's even also now, Midinesa B'minyan, because it was prohibited with a minyan, with a Sanhedrin. We don't play fast and loose with Chalav Yisrael, even though you don't think there's any pig milk in your milk, and it's very unlikely that there is. Nevertheless, you have to drink milk which is supervised by a Jew. Chalav Yisrael is absolutely compulsory. We can't change the rabbinic law. Comes along Rav Moshe Feinstein, and I've taken a very small extract from the tshuva. You should read the whole tshuva, of course. But he says in number 14, Lachain, Avshe Vadai Gazru Zebaminyan. He says, of course I agree that they made this in the Sanhedrin. Came to Medina Hayamutta. However, since originally this was Mutta, the only reason we don't drink milk from a non-Jewish farm is because rabbinically we worried they might have included some non-kosher milk, which of course is kosher, is treif d'oraisa. I'm not sure, he says, whether we can say it's osur when there's really no chance of any mixture of other milks. Because the Chazal made the gezeira when there was a concern. You can't say loy plug that, oh, they just made a gezeira flat, independent of the specific circumstances. Because it's clear that they made the gezeira because they were worried about non-kosher milk. The ha'asru rak b'she'ein Yisrael ro. That's why they said it's only also when there isn't a Jew there. The niflugu elu she'ein behem chashash eruv behechrog. And therefore, that would exclude things where there really is no concern. Came along Rav Moshe and said, "Look, I'm not overturning any gezeiras. Far be from me, Rav Moshe Feinstein, to start saying I disagree with the Sanhedrin. But it seems clear to me," said Rav Moshe, "the Sanhedrin only made a prohibition on non-Jewish milk when there was a real concern that it would be adulterated. When there is really no concern, so then there's no gezeira. They never made the gezeira for that. So in America today," he said, "that there really is no concern. And therefore there's no gezeira. Therefore you don't have to drink milk." He says, "A bal nefesh should, it's good to be machmir, etc., etc. But mitzad kashrus, in terms of the basic din of kashrus, there is no reason to chase after milk which was supervised by a Jew, because it's no different, it's no better than in halacha, the milk which was not supervised by a Jew, because it all has the same din. There's no concern that it's adulterated." That's why he came to that famous conclusion based on the underlying reason. So that
same thing,
right. These are all examples. I asked once the London based din, why was it that in America the psak of Rav Moshe is quite popular, even in the Mocharedi community. In England it's less popular. I asked him, is this because we're worried that in England the supervision of the milk is less intense than in America? And they said, no, it's nothing to do with that. The supervision of the milk in England is perfectly adequate. He says that Rav Moshe is less popular. Rav Moshe is not a posek for Anglia, he was a posek for America, and therefore in England they have different influences in halacha. But of course, if you go on holiday to Rwanda or Botswana, places like that, of course the halacha is absolutely the milk cannot be drunk. But then you get into shilas like, you go to Greece or somewhere like that, and it's part of the EU, but I don't know, it's Greece, is it not? Or is that just prejudice? Maybe they're more tough in Greece than they are in, Manchester. I don't know. Why should they not? So that's a question you have to ask a Shiloh when you go to Greece for your holidays. Fine. Let's move on, because we have about 25 minutes and we need to move on. Dancing and clapping on Shabbat. Now, it may come as a bit of a surprise to you that there's even an issue with dancing on Shabbat, because, everybody dances on Shabbat, that's what you do. You can't go to the kotel on Friday night and say, no dancing. That's the whole thing, it's all over, if there's no dancing. However, the Gemara clearly says, we'll see the Shulchan Aruch in a minute, it's also to dance on Shabbos. You can't dance. Why can't you dance on Shabbos? You can't clap, can't dance, can't click your fingers, because they're worried that once people start dancing, someone will whip out a musical instrument, they'll start playing, and they'll start making things and tuning them. Once you tune a musical instrument on Shabbos, that's a doraisa. To play a musical instrument is rabbanon, but to tune a guitar is doraisa. How can you not tune a guitar when you play? Therefore, no dancing, no clapping, no, none of this lively stuff, because soon people will be going crazy with their instruments. Says Tosfos, Tana, number 15. Ein matapkim ve'ein maraktim. We can't slap our thighs and clap, and we can't dance. Perish Rashi Shemi Takin Klishir. Maybe people will start. I don't know if it means making a musical instrument. People always say that making a musical instrument. Maybe improvising a musical instrument, that's tikkun kli. Certainly tuning a musical instrument is the easiest thing in the world. All instruments can be tuned. Flutes, drums, violins, everything can be tuned. Umihu lididam, but for us, says Tosfos, Shari, it's mutter to dance on Shabbos. The dafgu mehem shehayu bukiyim laso is kli. Only in those days when they used to do that kind of thing. Klishir. Then you can make a gezera avaladi dan, but for us, ainot bekim lasos klishir v'loy shayach lemikza. We just don't do this today. Don't worry, clap, don't be happy. It's fine on Shabbos. So again, you see, he says that the reason was X. The reason doesn't apply, and that's why he thinks that the halacha should change. There, actually, the Shulchan Aruch. I'm going to brush over it a little bit. The Shulchan Aruch writes that you can't clap and you can't dance and you can't do these things on Shabbos. The Mishnah Brura, the Ramah rather, when he says that these days we let people do it, he brings the Sfarah of Tosfos and says, well, maybe because it's changed, because the reality is different today. But he also says, but maybe it's because even if we tell them not to dance, they'll ignore us, and better they should do it the Shogeg than do it the Mazid. I remember still some, when I was a teenager, some grumpy old men telling me not to dance on Shabbos. I don't think anyone still says that anymore. I don't know, people still say you can't dance on Shabbos, also. But if you open the Shulchan Aruch, it's clearly also. You know, it's a strange thing, you know? But it seems that some things have moved in a certain direction, maybe because of this Tosfos as well. The last two I'm not going to go through in detail. I just want to mention Me'ein Sheva and Kiddush and Shul on Friday night. This is an interesting question. You may have noticed when you go to Eretz Yisrael that they do not make Kiddush and Shul on Friday night. But in Chutz La'aretz, almost everywhere, they do make Kiddush and Shul on Friday night. The reason that they made originally, the reason for making Kiddush and Shul on Friday night is why? Right, we paskin like Shmuel in the Machlokes and Arab Sof, and we paskin like Shmuel ain Kiddush Elu B'Mokum Suda. You have to make Kiddush where you eat, and therefore Kiddush and Shul will not help you when you go home. However, there used to be people who ate and slept, and they were resident in the Shul over Shabbos. We don't have that anymore. So comes along the Bet Yosef and says, fine, so go make Kiddush. I mean, you can't just stand up and make Brei Agafen and Mekadesh a Shabbos and Brochas in Thin Air for no reason when there's no, it doesn't do anything. Why are you making a brocha on Friday night, Mekadesh HaShabbos, when no one's yotze with that brocha? So he says, don't do it, you can't say, you can't make brochas levatola. And others come along, the Ran and others, and say, no, this is our minhag, it's now part of tefillah, we don't change it, even though the reason clearly has gone away. There are other reasons. It's now become part of the whole tefillah process. Even the Magen Avot, the Me'ein Sheva that we say at the end of Friday night, was for a reason that the reason's gone away. Chazoras HaShatz, which is sometimes cited as an example, the reason hasn't gone away. Sometimes people think the reasons have gone away. Chazoras HaShatz is to be motzi people who aren't able to daven. There are plenty of people who aren't able to daven. There are plenty of people who messed up the davening. They asked the Shliach Tzibah, please be motzi me with the davening. That still applies. Another one which is often cited is second day Yom Tov. Second day Yom Tov, which is everyone's favorite bugbear, right? They say, oh, second day Yom Tov, you know, it was made for this reason and that reason, and the reasons don't apply. That's just a mistake. It's just simply a mistake. When Chazal made the Gezerah, of second day Yom Tov, they already had a fixed calendar. They already knew which was the right day. They didn't have any suffix anymore. Nevertheless, even though they had the same situation that we have today, they said you still have to keep second day Yom Tov for various different reasons, which still apply today. And therefore, it's simply a mistake. I think it's willful ignorance in many ways that people think, oh, well, they only did it because they didn't know which was the right day, and today we do. That's not correct. And therefore, second day Yom Tov is here to stay, at least until we get a new Sanhedrin. So, that's how it works. What's this? Or you can move to Israel, which, of course, is probably a quicker than to get a new Sanhedrin. Okay, fine. But not necessarily any less stressful. I'm going to just mention briefly C, D, E, and F, because I don't have time to deal with everything in the 10 to 12 minutes that I've got left. There is a whole sugya of Mishnah HaTeva, which I'm not going to get into now. There are certain technological statements, scientific statements by Chazal, which don't seem to be true anymore. This could even be in Doraisis. Famous case, they say you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. Why? Even though you're not allowed to kill animals on Shabbos, it's an Issa Doraisa. Lice, say Chazal, you are allowed to kill, because they don't generate sexually. There are no male and female lice that make baby lice. They spontaneously generate from the environment in which we live, and therefore they're not included in the Issa Doraisa of killing an animal on Shabbos. But now today we know that they do not spontaneously generate. We have completely clear scientific evidence that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. So now, can you still kill lice on Shabbos? It seems that the whole heter was based on a scientific pronouncement that is not correct. What do we do with that? And I'm not even going to get into that because there's a whole discussion. Some people say, well, no, yes, we have to change the halacha now, be more machmir. Other people say, no, chas v'chalila, there's lots to say. Simani Trefus, when Chazal gave lists of certain diseases in animals, which means that the animal is trafe, it won't live more than 12 months. And other diseases, it will live more than 12 months. Well, now we have animals that have the diseases that Chazal say the animal can't live more than 12 months, and these animals live years because we have new techniques to treat them. So does that mean they're still trafe? Or are they not now trafe? That's a whole discussion which I'm not getting into. Chazal's medical advice. The Rambam is very stark. Rav Avraham ben Rambam. You don't follow Chazal's medical advice. That's not what you go to the doctor today. Why? What is the status of Chazal's medical advice? Have we changed? Did they get it wrong? Did they get it right? Well, that's a whole discussion which I'm not going to get into now. And there are a lot of examples in Halacha where Chazal experienced a certain scientific reality. They said, for example, a baby born in the 8th month of gestation will not live. And there are certain halakhas that follow from that in terms of the birth, in terms of Shabbos, all sorts of things. Today, the babies do live. Clearly they live. What changed? Is it just we have incubators? Is the halakha different? Everyone there will say the halakha is different. No one treats an 8-month gestated baby as any less likely to live today than a 9-month or a 7-month for that matter, which Chazal said is more likely. How that works again is a whole discussion which I'm not going to get into now. I put here the changes in underlying spiritual reality. Chazal talk about all sorts of things. Are they still relevant today? Ruach Ra. How does Ruach Ra work? We wash our hands in the morning because of Ruach Ra. Do we still have Ruach Ra today? What is Ruach Ra? What are demons? Do demons exist? Shadim, all these things based on that. The Rambam says there are no Shadim, and the Rambam says, yes, there are. So, well, what is it? So are there or aren't there? And how to resolve that apparent debate is a whole Torah in and of itself. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a beautiful piece at the end of Parshas Bo, trying to reconcile those things. That's again just something for you to think about and look into. Objective. The end of Parshas Bo, where with the Chartumim, with the magicians there in I think it's in Bo. Anyway, I can look at it later. Objective. Yes, absolutely, Yaakov. The objective changes in external social realities. This is a little bit easier. Chazal say you have to wear a belt when you daven. Why? Because you have to have your top half separated from your bottom half. And therefore, you know, today we have trousers. We have a waistband in the trousers. So, yeah, for men, this is more a halacha for men. So maybe that's just a technological difference. We don't need to wear a gartel anymore because we already have something there that changes the halacha. Reading by a lamp on Shabbos. So Chazal made a gezeira. You're not allowed to read by a lamp on Shabbos. Close reading. Why? Because you might fiddle with the lamp. Okay? You might come because the light's not working properly, and before you look around, you've broken Shabbos. Today, with electrical lights, there's no chance of doing that. You can fiddle whatever you like. It's not going to change the light. Okay? And therefore, even the Mishnah Berurah in his time says that this doesn't apply in the same way today. Interesting with a dimmer switch. If you have a dimmer switch, would that be the same? We're getting into that now. Rav Avadya has a very fascinating tshuva on deaf mutes. Chazal said a deaf mute is exempt from mitzvahs. Why? Because he's completely cut off from the world. Has no way of communicating. He's not got any doubts. He doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't count for a minion. Doesn't care. Doesn't do nothing. Finished. Rav Avadya says, well, 1 second. Today we have schools where they educate people who are deaf mute. And they contribute fully to society. And they know exactly what's going on because we've developed techniques to communicate with them and to get them to communicate with us. So he says, now they do count for a minion. It's interesting, again, a changing the social reality, which seems to have changed the halacha in some ways. F, which I'm not going to get into in detail, is also relevant, which is changes in people's capabilities. Do we have kavana today? A number of even in the Rishonim said, look, we just don't have kavana today. All the halachas that Chazal said about kavana, they just don't apply in the same way today. For example, you have to have kavana in the first brocha of the Amidah. And according to the strict letter of the Gemara, if you don't have kavana, you have to go back. And however many times you didn't have kavana, you have to go back. Because you have to have kavana in the first brocha, otherwise it's not tefillah. Says the Ramah, today we have no kavana anyway, so even if you go back, you'll have no. You won't do better the second time than the first time. Yeah? So there's no point going back. So we just change that halacha because people just can't cope with it today. One of my favorites is the last one before we get to G, which is sensitivity to the presence of malachim. The Gemara says that when you leave the bathroom, you say Ashiyatzar, and before you go in the bathroom, you turn around to the malachim, which accompany you everywhere you go, and you have a whole spiel to say to them. You basically say to them, excuse me, I have to go to the bathroom. Look, you're malachim, you don't have to go to the bathroom. Please wait for me because, you know, I'm only human, I have to do what I have to do, but I understand you're there, you're protecting me, and I want you to be there for me when I come back. It's a whole long speech. The Rambam passes this way. The Rambam, Mr. Rationalist Supreme, says, of course we speak to the Malachim. Like, how can you not? You know, they're there. The Shulchan Aruch brings this halacha. You speak to the Malachim, but then he says, but today we don't do that. Because who are you trying to kid? You think there are Malachim there? You think you can feel them? But in principle, you think it's strange when you walk out of the bathroom saying Ashayatzar. You know, think how strange it would be before you walk in the bathroom when your work colleague says, who are you speaking to just now? Before you went in the bathroom. Like you know, now you can just wear a Bluetooth and you could be speaking to, you know. Yeah. So again, something seems to have changed, which is it should be Malachim, not Malachim. Yeah, because that's the presence of kings is still there. Malachim, fine. Let's just look in the last. Do I have 10 minutes? Do I have 10 minutes? Because we started 10 minutes late, so I'd like to just do this because this is the if you like the interesting social stuff, which I'm really going to raise as questions rather than give any kind of answers. There are certain social changes that may well have introduced halachic changes as well. For example, in number 18, there is a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, it's a halacha in the Gemara, that says that there are women are not allowed to wear jewelry on Shabbat. They're not allowed to wear jewelry on Shabbat, even inside the house. Why? Because women will take off their jewelry outside, inside, show it to other people, look at my this, look at my that, bracelets, rings, whatever it was. And Chazal were worried that they'd be in the street, and they would take off jewelry, and they'd walk with the jewelry. Comes along Tosfos and says, no, women just don't do that anymore. Women just don't take off their jewelry and show them to people. And therefore, this halacha doesn't apply. If you look briefly at number 18, he says, at the end of the first line, V'ha'idna, these days, Nashe Didan, are the women in our society, Nagol, let's say, B'chol Tashita. They go out with all their jewelry on. When did you ever hear anyone say to a woman that you can't wear jewelry on Shabbos? He says, He says maybe it's because they won't listen, and therefore, like we said with the clapping of the dancing, Musaf Shiyushogim Valu Mezidim. But no, it says V'yeshu Lamdu Aleihem Schus V'lamashe Einog Is Gen Alpi Svarachron Shekhtati. He says maybe the difference is different today because they just don't take off their jewelry anymore, and therefore the halacha has changed because of the social change. Okay, again, a din d'rabbanan. Another din, which could be actually a doraisa, are you allowed to take a shower on Yom Tov? Oh. That's what gets the people, right? So in principle, when the Gemara discusses heating water on Yom Tov, it says you can heat water on Yom Tov for any need that you have, as long as it's something which the Gemara says is shava l'kol nefesh. It's something which is a regular need that most regular people have. If you're peculiar, you have special circumstances, you do this but no one else does, then that you can't heat things up or burn things for something which normal people don't do. So the Gemara says, what do normal people do? So they wash their hands, their face, their feet, whatever, every day. So that you can heat water for. But who bathes the whole body every day? No, it's unheard of. And therefore the Gemara says you cannot heat water to take a full body bath or shower on Yom Tov. Now the question is, I'm not to talk about Shabbos. Shabbos for sure, you can't heat water on Shabbos for any purposes because that's straight. It's a doraisa, it's a different thing. But Yom Tov, the question is, can you or can't you? And there are some poskim today that are more, if you like, firm in their, resolute in their understanding that the times have changed. Not that the halacha is, you know, different now because we're living in a modern world. But people shower every day. If people shower every day, then it is shava l'kol nefesh. Chazal didn't decree what is shava l'kol nefesh. They just said, if it's shava l'kol nefesh, if it's something which is for everybody, then you can do it. If not, then not. So, but there are still poskim that will say it's osa. It's a question of how much you take into account that social change. Smoking is a similar thing. Smoking was considered to be completely standard by everybody, and therefore musa on Yom Tov as well, lighting ceremony, but now smoking is a much less accepted thing done by far fewer people. Maybe it becomes also on Yom Tov. Maybe it's also the whole time because of the danger. I'm not getting into that, but certainly on Yom Tov. Yes?
But then it depends if you class yourself in a particularly sensitive. I mean, most people nowadays, definitely, most people shower.
Well, I mean, that's the point. It might depend on the cultural norms. In America, there's one thing, in England, there's another thing. might depend. So how far do you apply the halacha? Well, in this town, yes, in this town, no, in this country, yes, in this country, no. How does that work? How does that? That's an interesting question. Let me mention G3, which is marrying within 24 months of giving birth. Chazal made a gezeira. With the Chazal made a takana, actually not a gezeira, that if a woman has a baby and then God forbid the husband dies or they get divorced, she cannot marry another man for 2 years, for 24 months. Remarry. Remarrying. I mean, remarrying is also marrying. Okay, I'm not talking about someone who had a baby before they got married later. Fine. So if a woman has a baby when she's married already and then she wants to remarry a different man, so she says she can't. Why not? Because Chazal say, look, it goes like this. If she remarries, she could easily get pregnant, and she's nursing the first baby. Nursing is not a guaranteed way of avoiding pregnancy. A number of people have found that out to their great surprise over the centuries. But it's true. Chazal said that if a woman is nursing, she will possibly get pregnant, but then the milk will dry up, and who's going to feed the first baby? So she's going to have to hire a wet nurse, and who's going to pay for that? She's got no money. Where's she going to get money from? She's got no independent income. She's going to rely on the stepfather. The stepfather's going to pay for to nurse Yenem's baby. Chazal said, no. We're going to basically say she can't remarry for 24 months, so the baby is weaned, it's on solids, there's no problem. It was a takana to protect the welfare of the young baby. So today, what relevance does this have anymore? The woman, first of all, probably has independent income today. Secondly, people don't normally feed their babies and nurse their babies for 24 months. And even if they do, there's formula, they can just get it in there. How does this work? And there's a whole shuva of Rav Moshe in number 20 there, where he says, no, Taka, maybe we can change this halacha today. We can bring that period of time back. And we can say it's not 24 months, it's 18 months, and maybe there'll be some people who say it's less than that. Again, it's the social reality which seems to make have an impact on the halacha. G4 and G5 are massive topics. How do we relate to non-Jews today? When Chazal talk about relations with non-Jews, who are they talking about? Are they talking about pagans? Are they talking about the people who live next door on Albert Road? Who are they talking about? And there you'll find massive differences of approach, very much hashkafically influenced as to how that works. I'm not getting into that today. Non-religious Jews, perhaps an even more pressing issue when the Gemara describes heretics, people who don't believe this, people who don't believe that. Are these the people that we live with today? Are they describing different people? This is a massive topic in and of itself. G6, I'll just mention, walking behind a woman, the Shulchan Aruch says very clearly, if you're out in the marketplace and you end up walking behind a woman, you have to run to the side. You're not allowed to walk behind a woman in the street. A man, because we're worried that he's going to be looking inappropriately at the woman, it's osur to do that. It's osur. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman in number 22, I'll leave you to read it on your own. Rav Shlomo Zalman says in number 22, today we live in a world in which women are out in the street the whole time. They lived in a world in which women were rarely in the street. And therefore, if you end up walking behind a woman, it's a whole revolution. But now, everyone, they said there are more women in the street than men, which is clearly the case. And therefore, this halacha doesn't apply in the same way. This sounds like a very revolutionary fact, but actually he's coming from the same idea. Women's Torah learning I'm not even going to get into. Suffice it to say that if anyone says to you, women are not allowed to learn Gemara, and you ask them why, and they say, because it says in Shulchan Aruch they're not allowed to learn Gemara, that's quite correct. It says that in Shulchan Aruch. It also says in Shulchan Aruch they're not allowed to learn Chumash Rashi either. Clearly, the same Shulchan Aruch says they're not allowed to learn Chumash either. So if someone starts to talk about the Shulchan Aruch, you end up with the debate, well, clearly we don't pass like the Shulchan Aruch. There's not a community in the world that doesn't teach their women some kind of Torah. Therefore, how are we going to find our halacha? That's a whole big debate. Page 5 is probably the most controversial. I'll let you look at it on your own. You know, women's public roles and how that works and how that doesn't work. You know, our women, the Mishnah Brewer here, paskens that even though a woman can make kiddush for a man, a woman shouldn't publicly make kiddush for a group of men who are not her family. Why? Because it like cheapens the mitzvah to publicly appoint a woman to make a kiddush, even though in halacha there is no reason why a woman can't make kiddush for a man. This is not appropriate. The question is that still the case? does that apply independently of the status and role of women in society? Or do you turn around and say, well, no, today now women are running multi-billion dollar corporations and they're prime ministers, etc. In what way exactly does it cheapen a mitzvah to ask a woman to do it publicly? That's a whole debate to have based on the Mishnah Brura. I brought you a couple of pieces of Rav Soloveitchik about divorce, agunas, and marriage annulment. These are all massive topics, which there's lots and lots written on. When Chazal make a statement that a woman would prefer to be married to a man than to be single, even if it turns out that the man is not in any sense ideal as a husband, is that still true? Or is that dependent on some social reality of the time of Chazal? And Rav Soloveitchik says, Chas v'chalilei, says, no, absolutely not. We don't make halacha dependent on a social reality. Well, clearly in some cases we do. The question is when yes and when no. That depends on the whole meta-halachic ability to judge and to balance these things. You can't just reach for opinions in the Rishonim. I'll find you opinions in the Rishonim that say you can call up women for aliyahs on Shabbos. I'll find you those opinions. The point here is not whether those opinions exist, it's how they fit into the halachic process. It's not good enough just to say, well, look at him, he said you can. You have to see way up how does that work in a much bigger picture. And very often, this is something which is not done. Someone just points to an opinion and say, oh, well, look, you see, the rabbis are being restrictive today. It's not as simple as that. There is not just it's not a free-for-all. I brought you here a bat mitzvah, which is something which clearly has evolved over the last 50 years. Bat mitzvah used to be seen as something completely trait. Completely reformed in certain areas of certain parts of the Jewish people, it still is, but in certain parts of the Jewish people, it absolutely is not. And it's seen as being a very appropriate way of celebrating. That's not such a halachic issue, that's more a scholastic issue. Women in Kaddish, I mentioned here. Women's aliyahs, also I mentioned women, men and women singing zmiris together. The very famous tshuva of the Sri De'esh, where he talks about the reality of the youth and the need for them to be singing together in the youth group, and how he fits that together with the Isser of Kol Isha, and comes to a kind of a Peshara, some kind of a solution at the end. All of these, I think, are examples of how the reasons impact on the halacha. And again, all we've done today is just give you a list of areas which need to be looked at in more detail. You're welcome to go and look at those in more detail, either on my website or other places. I would just finish with just a 1 minute thought that this is, of course, a very major debate as to the whole legacy of Hanukkah itself. Just on the last day of Hanukkah, Zois Hanukkah, the question of what to do with the legacy of the Greeks. The Greeks are a very confusing people to us, because on the one hand there is something very dangerous and rotten at the core of their ideology. On the other hand, there is a beauty and there is a chokhmah, there is a wisdom which fits very strongly with the way the Jewish mind works. And therefore the legacy of the Greeks is one in which the Jewish people are trying to work out, do we take Greek methodology here, finding reasons and logic and understanding mitzvahs and making them dependent to some degree on reasoning, do we take that logic and employ it within the Jewish system? Or do we reject even the Greek systems, never mind the actual underlying culture, how we do that? Rav Cook has a very beautiful piece on that, where he says that the Greek language is acceptable to Judaism, but the Greek culture is not. And other people, of course, will disagree. This is part of the whole debate as to how we actually apply logical, rational understanding to the concepts of mitzvahs and Torah, which is revelation-based, not rationally based necessarily. And that is an ongoing debate which has been going for centuries, millennia even, and will continue to go. So I apologize for going a little over time, but I thank you very much again for inviting me. I wish you all a Hanukkah Sameach, what's left of it, and hope to see you on future occasions. Be'ezrat Hashem.